It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
A little known history about the Eastern Shore finds that over 1,000 African Americans joined the Union Army during the Civil War. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Across the North, there were nearly 190,000 free blacks and former slaves who were enlisted into the Union Army, and more than 1,200 of them came from the Lower Shore. This statistic comes at a time as debate rages over the fate of Confederate monuments across the country and here on Delmarva. Take a look at the contributions of these African-American soldiers. We have in our studio this morning Clara Small. She is Professor Emeritus of History at Salisbury University. She's also co-authored a number of books, including Men of Color to Arms and Hearts Were Loyal. Of course, I've sort of shortened the names there just for time's sake. Welcome to the program, Clara.
Good morning. Thank you.
So tell me a little bit about, first of all, this fact that we don't pay a lot of attention necessarily to the kinds of contributions that African-American soldiers played in terms of the Union Army.
Well, the problem is that we have not been taught because it's not in front of our faces. Most people just ignore the fact that African-Americans did participate in the Civil War. There's so many stories that blacks did nothing to free themselves, and because the stories are not told, primarily because history is written about us and not usually by us. And so most of the individuals who served in the Civil War from this area were slaves. 68%, 32% were free. So since they were illiterate, most of them were not writing their stories. So we don't know. Until recently, there's a new push to put the information out, and plus the government's releasing more information. So now we're getting to know a lot of this information, and families are trying to find out about their ancestors. And because of that, they're going through documents, and many of those documents have been thrown out with the trash because people didn't realize just how valuable those documents were. So people want to find out about themselves and finding out about their ancestors.
So, as a matter of fact, now, as I understand it, there were a number of ways that you could get into the Union Army. I mean, particularly if you were a slave, you may not have had a choice.
Of course not. There was no choice. Well, first of all, the Civil War was not about freeing slaves. Slavery was just one of those issues. And when everybody thought that the Civil War was going to be such a short war, and it turned out to be not that. So the end result was that, Lincoln said, I will come up with some way to change matters. And you had to do it politically as well as strategically. So Lincoln came up with a preliminary Emancipation Proclamation.
Right.
The goal was to bring the South back into the Union. That was his overall goal. And in order to do so, the Union Army had to have a victory. That didn't happen until 1862. And some people still debating whether that's a victory or not. It was a victory or not at Antietam. And so he said, I will have a preliminary Emancipation Proclamation. That came out in September of 1862. Lincoln gave the South precisely 100 days to return to the Union. He said, if you don't, I will issue this Emancipation Proclamation. And he did, because the South thought, it was just a little piece of paper that didn't mean anything. So the war continued. And many of the states never did have enough soldiers. So what do you do if you don't have enough soldiers to fight an effective war? Come up with another solution. Allow free blacks to join. Still, Maryland never did have enough soldiers. So, free the slaves. And in the process, there was such a reaction, the slaveholder said, what are we going to do? Either freedom or be taxed exorbitantly. So, slaveholders freed their slaves. They manumitted them, their term for freeing. And every slaveholder got $300 for every able-bodied slave. Imagine someone such as Curtis Jacobs from Worcester County, who had a vast amount of slaves. He made quite a bit of money. But not everybody received $300 because of disloyalty to the Union.
So in terms of the emancipation, because one of the things that we seem to oftentimes overlook, and I think you sort of allude to it, is the fact that Emancipation Proclamation didn't apply across the board, but there were states, Missouri, Kentucky, Maryland, Delaware, for
border
example,
states.
That were exempt. That said, oh, well, okay.
They remain in the Union.
Right.
And that took a lot of doing for Lincoln to play politics so that he could keep those states in the Union, especially West Virginia, what became West Virginia. Maryland was particularly important because if Maryland had left the Union, D.C. would have been surrounded. So Lincoln had to play politics with the governor, Governor Hicks, who was from Cambridge,
right,
to keep Maryland in the Union. And the promise was that the soldiers from Maryland would not have to leave the state. All they would have to do is protect Maryland and D.C. But there was a skirmish down in on the eastern shore of Virginia, and they were sent out of the state. So that caused quite a bit of a rift, and so many of the soldiers simply left.
Hmm.
So again, Maryland lost more soldiers, and the quota still was never met.
Now, so by the way, you know, the experience of the black soldier in the Union Army was, of course, celebrated in film, Glory.
Glory.
How
accurate,
or what's your sense about
Denzel?
Denzel, amongst others, yes. Morgan Freeman.
Yes. Right?
Did they get it right, do you think?
In most instances, yes. They did a marvelous job, but part of it was you have to play, you have to add something to make people watch it.
Right.
Okay. So they got most of it correct. Not all slaves and not all free blacks were that joyous and that religious. No, they were not.
They weren't enthusiastic?
Not really, but the goal was the promise of freedom at the end of the war.
Mm. So in terms of the folks here, one of the stories that's been told is about Carr Handy. Tell me a little bit about Carr Handy.
Oh, Carr Handy was a slave from what became this county. His father had been sold in Prince's Ann at the auction block because he refused to work because it was extremely hot, and he said he wasn't working. So they simply sold him down to Georgia. Well, Carr Handy was a slave. He was freed by his owner, and he was not, I guess you could say, he lost the right arm in the war. So he was discharged on the Surgeon's General's disability, a certificate of disability. And once he returned from the war, the first thing he did was try to find a way to survive. Now, he was a waterman and became a farmer as well. And the second thing he did was to find his father, to go to Georgia, find out who the owner was. And he found his father and brought him home. And every Sunday they would have a celebration. And I was doing a presentation just before the book came out. And his great-great-grandson, John Handy, here in Salisbury, said, I have something to show you. He had a picture of him, a portrait of him. And he came just before the presentation started. And that's how I got to know a lot about Carr Handy. More than just the basic information that I found in the records, but family history.
So how did he lose his arm?
He was shot off in battle.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And he was part of, I guess, the 7th Regiment, is that right?
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about that.
The 7th Regiment was one of 6 major regiments that the soldiers from this area were a part of. It's usually the 4th, 7th, 9th, 19th, 30th, and 39th. Those 6 regiments comprised most of the soldiers from this area, most of them. But there were about 50 different regiments that soldiers belonged to from this area. Because many slaves had been sent to other places by their owners. as apprentices, as servants from family members. So there are some who served in the 54th Massachusetts that came out of that area, Louisiana, you name it. They were all over the place, even Ohio. But the 7th Regiment was maybe one of the most famous regiments, but also lost a large number of soldiers in some of the major battles. Sometimes black soldiers were put on the front line, even though they were not that well trained. They suffered from being killed discriminately, you know, when they were captured and they were treated as prisoners of war along with their white commanders. The best example of that was Fort Pillow in Tennessee, where over 300 of them were put to death, even though they were waving the white flag. And that included women and children, and put in a little mass, a mass grave. So that was one of the things. And many of them died in prisons in Richmond, Wilmington, North Carolina, and Salisbury, North Carolina. And some pictures, and those soldiers were emaciated. They looked as if they were from concentration camps. So poor training. One-fourth of the soldiers died within 6 months of being recruited because of unsanitary conditions, because where they were stationed and trained was some of the most inhospitable areas of all.
And I guess they were also, but eventually they, part of it showed up at Appomattox.
Yes.
Which was quite startling for Robert E. Lee.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And their story, the story of black soldiers, I should say colored soldiers, because that's the term that was used during that time, is a story of perseverance. It's a story of trying to gain freedom, but there were hardships along the way. And for even white commanders to be in charge of them, they considered that to be a step down, an embarrassment for them to serve as their commanders.
And the other person, by the way, Isaiah Fawcett. Tell me a little bit about Isaiah.
Oh, Isaiah Fawcett. One of his descendants, Reverend David Burdell, he and I co-authored the book. Isaiah Fawcett and three of his brothers belonged to Sarah Brough in Senapuxkin area. Isaiah Fawcett survived war. He was not maimed in the same way that Carhander was. When he returned, he went into I think he was working with carpentry and other things. And he was one of the next to the last individuals to from the Civil War in the area. But most people call him Uncle Zier.
Why is that?
That was just a nickname.
Okay?
And when Reverend Burdell contacted me, it was a result of, Memorial Day program that they were having down in Berlin. And he said, well, okay, he knew about this man. He called him uncle, but he didn't realize that he was actually his granduncle. And so they were going to do a celebration, and as they started talking about the celebration, they said, well, it's only about five or six blacks who had served during the Civil War from the area. And then he said, well, okay, I need to do more research. So they told him, contact me. So he contacted me. I said, well, it's more than that, because I had already been working on slaves who had been manumitted to serve in the Civil War. And I had a long list. So did a lawyer down in Berlin. And so we started putting it together, and we came up with 637, I believe. 647. But anyway, and those are the ones that we can document.
Right.
And the reason why I'm saying can document is because there's a whole stack that I have of soldiers that are merely listed as belonging to the Eastern Shore of Maryland. We don't have the county identify, the city, the town, the little junction, and some of the little towns have gone out of existence. So we don't know specifically what county they were from. So at some point, I'm going to have to do an addendum to these books and simply say Eastern Shore of Maryland, because we can't, we don't know.
It's a term, facet. There's a story I ran across where at one point they clearly, obviously didn't have a choice.
No.
There's a story about how he stopped at some clearing and there was some kind of lynching. Yeah. Tell me a little bit about that. I mean.
Okay.
What's the background behind that?
That Reverend Verdell could tell that story better than I.
Okay. But go ahead.
He stopped and he just didn't want to go on, but he realized at that point that person may have been a soldier that simply wanted to desert. Okay. And that's my understanding of it. And I forgot to read over that part again. But the thing is, you either follow the rules that you were given and you continued on. So Facet simply said, let me go continue to move forward. Yeah. Hmm.
So he returns to Berlin.
Yes.
And
fathers, 8 children.
Yeah. I mean, how important was his participation in the Civil War, the soldier, to his family? I mean, was his family aware of this legacy? Did they talk about it much?
Yes, he talked about it. But most soldiers didn't talk about it for a number of years because of Reconstruction was such a harsh period. Many families didn't even know that their ancestors had even served in the Civil War. And documents that they have, even today, they're not even aware of how valuable those documents are. Someone showed me a document of one of his ancestors, a man named Moses Chester. His great-great-grandson, nephew, was Lemuel Chester out of Cambridge. And when he showed it to me, I almost fell out. I said, oh, my God. He said, what's wrong? I said, it was much like a monument document. The front of it looks like a monument. Mm-hmm. It had the name of the soldier, his height, his complexion, color of his hair, color of his eyes, the regiment he served in, his next of kin, name his wife and children. I mean, that's genealogy there. He did not realize how important it was. And he said, if he had realized how important it was and that ancestor had served, he would not have been the person that he was. He would have had pride in his heritage.
Speaking of that, I mentioned and alluded to in the opening that there's a lot of discussion about Confederate statues and so on. We have, it's obviously one of the most famous around here is the Talbot Boys, right? Mm-hmm. And I guess at this point, it's going to stay without any changes whatsoever. What do you make of that movement? The fact that not only Union soldiers are not necessarily represented at some of these sites, but that African-American soldiers aren't represented at these sites.
It's as if they didn't exist. As if their participation was negligible. What we have to do as historians and social scientists is teach a better way to be more inclusive of history. And not just about African Americans, women's history, everybody's history, because American history is like a mosaic, okay? And when you exclude different groups, you exclude people who made a difference, you are not giving the full picture of this country. And that has been the problem. If you tell the story and you tell it right, there will not be this divisiveness. And that's one of the basic problems we have. Because people don't understand. And when you see a Confederate flag, many people say, oh, that's racist. That's about the Civil War. But what about the other side of it? Okay. What about the role of women in the war? Women were taking care of families when their men were gone. trying to survive to keep the families together. That's not even talked about. Only I've only seen a few books of women, what women were doing during the Civil War. If it had not been for the women, the families would not have survived. See, there's so many elements of it that we just simply ignore. We just so narrowly focus.
Why do you think that is?
Part of it is the fact that some of the people who are teaching it don't know. They haven't read. They have not been taught. They have been very selective in the classes that they've taken, and they don't know. So if they don't know, how can they teach it?
Which leads me, by the way, the story you told, I guess, just before we went on the air, about how you got into this. How did you get into writing about it? Tell me about that story.
Oh, my gosh. I was hired from Lincoln University in Jefferson City, Missouri, by Salisbury University, Salisbury State University at the time, Salisbury State College. And the first class I taught was African-American history, because that was one of my major areas. And for years, I taught at least one semester of that, and sometimes two semesters. Well, on one Friday afternoon about, 98, 97, on a Friday afternoon, a student said, in my African-American history class, which was so devastating, he said, blacks have never done anything in this country and definitely not on the Eastern Shore. And I said to myself, I know he didn't say that. So I said, would you repeat yourself? And he did. And I said, oh, my God, this is what I'm thinking. So I'm going to kill this kid. I'm going to kill him. And then my parents' faces flashed before my eyes and said, you can't go to jail right now. You have too much to do. So I said, okay, I'm going to steam coming out of everywhere. So I said, okay, everybody, go home. Read everything I've assigned for up till next Friday. Be ready for Monday, because I'm going to throw everything I can at you on Monday, so be ready. So I went home, got in the middle of my bed with a, it wasn't a laptop at the time. It was a, what was it?
You had a typewriter, right?
Oh, almost like that.
Right.
Oh, yeah. So I said, okay, and I typed all night. Just feverishly typing. I was going crazy. I typed a 32-page document. I looked at it that Saturday afternoon. After going to church Sunday morning, I came to campus to make a copy for everybody in the class. I'm running off 32 pages for everybody. And in the process, it got late in that night, and the then president was Dr. Murren. He came to Holloway Hall, the third floor, and I was up there still Xeroxing. He said, what's going on? I said, well, I have to have this ready for tomorrow. He said, why? And I explained to him about the student. He said, was the student crazy? I said, no, uninformed. He was just uninformed. He will be by tomorrow. So he said, give me a copy. I gave him a copy. He went to Hawaii the next day. Tuesday, he called back to campus to public relations and publicity. Said, get in touch with Clara Small. She has a document. I read through it. It's okay. Just double check everything and put a red, black, and green cover on it. And I want it ready to go to every school in the Tri-County area. And after that, he said, well, make sure that it gets there to all the schools. And I did. And then it ran off over 300 copies, and, you know, the school sold it. But the thing was, that's what started me writing. And in that little book, which was entitled Reality Check, Brief Biographies of African Americans on Del Marva, like a page for Harriet Tubman, a page for Frederick Douglass, half of a page for someone else. And that started the Compass Points. One, 56 African-Americans in that came out in 2014. Compass Points 2, 76, Volume 2, African-Americans on Del Marva. And Working with the Soldiers, Men of Color to Arms, 2010. And 2017, They Were Blue and Their Hearts Were Loyal, Dorchester County. So much information that we did two counties in men of color, Somerset and Worcester County. But for Dorchester County, there was so much more information. We had to have one book for that. And it's going to be one book for Talbot County. And I've already found 631 soldiers for Talbot County alone. So that's what got me started, trying to save this history, because I found that no one else had been doing it. And I wanted to just pull it together and to help individuals know, I mean, not just blacks, but whites, but everybody know that there's this rich history here. And I've interviewed not just blacks, but whites as well, because this is one of the richest areas in the country in terms of history. I mean, really, because my dissertation was on a man who came to Virginia around 1625.
Who was that?
A man named William Ennis.
Mm-hmm.
He was not black.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, as a matter of fact, we have looked at his family through about 15 generations. 15 generations right here in this area. And my dissertation was the William Ennis family, demographic study of the family through three generations. And I was still writing, and my professors at the University of Delaware said, "You've proven your point already." I said, "Thank you."
Let me ask you this. So I'm obviously probably interact with students today. The incident you talk about was in the late 90s.
Mm-hmm.
Have things changed? What kind of sense do you get about the awareness of folks, the millennial generation, to this kind of history or this kind of accomplishments?
Disbelief. Disbelief, because trying to find it in history books, it's not there in most instances.
Still not.
Even for local history. And so when black history comes, sometimes they're just thirsting for knowledge, some of them, and still disbelief. And Black History Month, you find a lot of documentaries and what have you. So it's a question of how serious are teachers, how serious are departments about teaching it, being inclusive of the history, how serious are people in wanting to learn. And I've always believed that if you accept a person and not a group of people, and you get to know a person, it will make more sense than simply looking at a group of people and simply say, "Oh, well, I don't want to know them." My parents always taught us, okay, get to know the person, get to know the individual. And with my heritage, hey, I'm a mutt. My great-great-grandfather was white, okay? I'm Native American, African. So, you know, if I deny one part of my heritage, I'm denying myself and my family.
Do you think that's what this country tends to do, is to deny heritage? I mean, obviously,
yes.
We have a sort of political atmosphere, but even beyond that?
Oh, yeah. It says if you're denying that other people exist, that other people had a stake in this country, and it tends to make people think that, okay, well, I'm not important. So why should I continue to try to work, to volunteer to do this or that? No. And some people simply say, they don't want me here. Yeah.
Do you have any optimism that this is going to change? I mean, obviously, things have there's been tremendous changes, obviously, certainly in your lifetime, in my lifetime, to say the least, but
it's as if we've gone back about 40, 50 years in many respects.
You have a sense?
Yeah. And the thing is, our future is going to depend upon the young people, because they, most of them started kindergarten and went to school with people who are different than themselves. And many of them get to know people, know them, not a group, but individuals. And kids, when they start kindergarten and when they're in school, up until about the seventh grade, they don't know color. It is something that is taught. They don't know racism or sexism. That's something that is taught. Yeah. So our future really depends upon young people. And sometimes you got to keep the older folks out of this. I'm old too, so I'm 71, doesn't matter. But what I'm saying is that if you allow young people to associate with each other, it's not a problem. Racism is taught. Sexism is taught. Discrimination is taught. It's a shame that it has deteriorated to that point. So we've got to do a better job as individuals to sometimes just simply say, okay, let me get to know this person. Not put a label on this person. So that's the way I was taught. And I'm a Southerner.
And you're a Southerner. It's
North Carolina.
Well, you still will say, okay. But were you born here at all? Were you born here? No, you came here.
I came here in 77.
Oh, okay. All right.
Which, of course, means most people simply say, you'd never be accepted because you were not born and raised here, which is okay with me. Hey.
Right.
And I, as I said, sometimes you have to ignore certain things and just say, sure. Hey, keep on moving.
We've been speaking with Clara Small. She is a professor emeritus of history at Salisbury University. Mm-hmm. Also has co-authored a number of books, two of them, Men of Color to Arms, and also Hearts Were Loyal, about the African-Americans who joined or were enlisted into the Union Army during the Civil War. And we appreciate you stopping by and chatting with us this morning.
All right. Thank you.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
Pick peace, bring the banjo and the fiddle, pick peace, and we'll all meet in the middle, pick peace.
IBMA award-winning vocalist, songwriter, fiddle player of the year, Becky Buller, has released a new album, Cray Paper Heart. Becky, my guest on the next episode of Steve Martin's Unreal Bluegrass, this Sunday, 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern on WSDL 90.7 FM, Delmarva Public Radio.
Pick peace.
We're always on the lookout for exciting new music and for righteous gems from the past that just feel right again. We're not looking for a particular genre of music, just top quality and artists that communicate a broad-minded, inclusive set of values. Hey, I'm Greg McVicker, and I hope you'll make Undercurrents a regular part of your evening routine. Weeknights at 9 p.m. on WSDL, 90.7 Rhythm and News.
As we celebrate Black History Month, there's a new children's book out marking the contribution of Black women in America. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. The book is entitled Little Leaders, Bold Women in Black History, and its author and illustrator is Vashti Harrison, who hails from Accomack County. It recently won the NAACP Image Award for Outstanding Literary Work for Children, and she dedicated the award to all Black women in American history, and especially the little girls. And we have her on the line with us this morning. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So let me ask you this. So where did this idea come from in terms of producing this this book?
It really only started about a year ago this month. As an illustrator, I was really just looking for something to do for myself, just a project to keep me excited about drawing. Sometimes when the deadlines get really heavy, it gets hard to remember that you like to do the things that you do. So I was inspired by other challenges, like a lot of social media folks would get involved in these drawing challenges, like Inktober. Artists will draw and paint with ink every day for the month of October, or Mermaid, where you draw a mermaid every day for the month of May. So I really just wanted to create one that was all my own. And it, Black History Month was coming up, and I thought this was going to be a great opportunity for me to, one, learn about American history, and two, just, you know, feel excited about drawing Black women. I felt particularly inspired by the themes of Black History Month. When Carter G. Woodson started Negro History Week in 1926, the sentiment behind it was to focus on the stories that have been long neglected throughout history. And I felt really inspired to focus on the stories of Black women in particular, whose stories have been doubly neglected through history, you know, being women and being people of color. So, you know, it was just supposed to be a sweet, fun project that I would, you know, draw a character and post it on the internet and then you know, move on to the next day. But after the first one, it was kind of impressive to see how people were responding to it. I spent a lot of time on social media, so I have a good kind of gauge on the analytics, and it was kind of through the roof. It was more people were, there was more buzz around these posts than I had ever seen before. So I knew immediately that it would be a project that would be mean something a lot to me and mean a lot to people who follow my work and beyond.
Now, you started with Sojourner Truth. Why there?
Mm-hmm. You know, it felt like a good starting point. What I was really interested in doing was I felt like I was hearing a lot of the same stories over and over again every year during Black History Month. And I really just wanted to focus on some of the people I've never heard of, or in the case of Sojourner Truth, focus on the part of the story that I hadn't heard before. So I'd known of her name as, you know, a name associated with abolitionists and women's rights, but I wanted to just know a little bit more about her. And I was reading her story. It was like, you know, 4 o'clock in the morning on January 31st, or I guess February 1st, I was getting ready to post this first drawing. And I was just weeping with, you know, I was just so overcome with emotion because her story is so powerful. You know, I really connected to this kind of passion she had for getting her family back together. And, you know, it was just, you know, I don't have children. I don't know what it's like to be a mother, but I was reading her story about how her little boy was sold to a plantation. She was living in upstate New York, and the Gradual Emancipation Act was rolling out in New York, and so she had been promised her freedom, but, you know, to, I guess, capitalize on the profits of having slaves, her slave owner sold her little boy, her 5-year-old son, to a plantation in Alabama over 200 miles away. And, you know, despite how incredibly terrifying that would be, I don't know how I would get from upstate New York to Alabama to 2018, you know, like I have no idea how I would do that without any resources and being a person of color, you know, in a place where nothing is made easy for you, you know. It was just terrifying. But somehow she found a way, and she filed a lawsuit and was the first African-American woman in America to successfully file a lawsuit and win in America. And somehow she got him back. And it's such a beautiful, powerful story about love for family and going after the things that are really, really important. So I wanted to kind of tap into that moment for each of these stories. I wanted to connect emotionally. I'd never really considered myself this really empathic, empathetic person, but it was that really beautiful moment of passion and joy and love that I wanted to bring out in all of these stories.
Now, you, when you draw these, they're all basically young girls, all basically looking the same. What was the idea behind them not taking on the, for instance, the physical characteristics of the actual person?
Yeah, so I was thinking a lot about how children connect with stories. So I really wanted it to feel like this character that I created, the little leader, what I might call the little leader character, is just easy and accessible, and is a character that little ones can identify with. I could have gone in and represented each of these women representationally, you know, but I thought it was important to make them children and think of them as dressing up as these famous people so that it might be an easier entry point for kids to identify with the stories or to learn about them. In my work, I really love the illustrations, the classic mid-century style illustrations, what they would call the golden era of children's books. So I was thinking a lot about that when I was creating the style. I really love Mary Blair and Roger Hargraves, who made the Little Miss Sunshine and Mr. Happy books. I was thinking about this kind of really sweet vintage style, and I wanted to see little black girls represented that way. because when you think about like the Madelines and the Eloises, they're the epitome of innocent and young, and there are all these studies that say that little black girls are seen as less innocent and more adult than other girls in their same age group. And so, you know, that kind of thing just breaks my heart. So, like, I don't do much. I draw pictures for a living. So if I can with my artwork remind folks that all kids are kids and all kids are innocent, I'll do that. So I was definitely thinking about kind of the conceptual side of things when I made those creative choices.
Now, the other thing I noticed, and others obviously, is that the eyes are downcast. I think I ran a quote where it says that it's like a pose of serenity. What was the idea behind having them with their eyes downcast, not looking at you?
Yeah, it ties right into that kind of vintage style illustrations. It's, for me, that pose, it's kind of like a shorthand for innocent, for serene. You know, I think about the cover of like Mr. Happy where, he's posed that way. And I just, when I think of it, it's just, he's not smiling a big smile, but his name is Mr. Happy. Something about that just, I feel is really, really powerful because, it's sort of as if he's like looking at with inside himself. And so that was what I was really going for. I love one of the reviewers wrote something that in a way each of the little girls is like looking with inside of themselves to emulate this person, and I definitely really love that because the illustrations, the characters and the costumes are very rendered, whereas the backgrounds are more simplified, and I kind of wanted them to feel like doodles or sketches in a way that it's sort of like the idea of a background in the way that a child might play pretend, might dress up and play pretend. So I love that idea of kind of looking what's inside of yourself. But and then on the other side of things, like people ask me like, well, you know, how are their eyes closed? And, you know, how are they, if they're so little, how can they be bold women? And I mean, I grew up as a really kind of quiet kid, really introverted, and that didn't preclude me from becoming a bold person. So for me, it's really important to just, you know, showcase and remind people that, you know, boldness doesn't have to look a certain way. You know, for example, one of the stories in the book is Alma Woodsy Thomas, who painted all of her life and kind of had major successes in her artistic career when she was 80 years old. Just amazing and incredible. But, you know, sometimes the boldness comes from patience and working really hard, and it doesn't have to look like, you know, standing on a mountaintop and, you know, climbing the Himalayas. It's, you know, boldness and bravery, you know, and leadership can be exhibited in many different ways.
Now, by the way, did you have any particular favorite or one that struck you the most out of all these? I mean, you got 40 of them, and actually, as you indicated, yeah, in the back of the book, there were so many more that you couldn't include, right? Was there any particular one that drew your attention?
I do have a soft spot for artists. So I really love Alma Woodsy Thomas. I really love Augusta Savage, who is a sculptor during the Harlem Renaissance period. What I love most about her story is that it was not easy for her. Every step of the way, there were struggles. Her father didn't approve of her creativity. When she moved to Harlem to, you know, be in the Harlem Renaissance and be around all these amazing other artists, she still struggled with finances. She struggled with racism in the institution. She struggled with, you know, having a place to live. It was just, you know, constantly hard. And I think that, you know, it's important to recognize, like, you know, these are not, and they're not simple stories, and it's really beautiful that she persevered through, and somehow, you know, every step of the way, there was always something to save her. So, you know, someone would step in and, you know, get her a residency or get her more commissions through the public library. You know, it's hard to be a sculptor. I can't imagine trying to make a career. You know, it's hard to be an artist in a world that, you know, operates not on artistic endeavors, but you know, it's just really beautiful and powerful to me to know that she still continued to do it. And she was just so immensely talented. And even though her works were never, you know, she had these amazing ideas for giant, huge cast bronze statues, and she never had the funds to make them. So every one of her plaster models, you know, it doesn't exist anymore. But she began to teach. She started teaching when she was a young person, when she was about 15 years old, teaching her peers. And she thought that her legacy could live on through the hard work of her students. And I think that that's so beautiful.
By the way, I did want to ask you about actually one of my more favorite authors, which is Zora Neale Hurston. She obviously wrote the novel Their Eyes Watching God, and the opening is quite remarkable. But one of the things I liked about her books, and I ran across a series of short stories, is that in Eanville, that all the stories are within the African-American community, and that they're not pushed back against a backdrop of white society, that the African-Americans in her stories are in and of themselves and not defined by that other that's going on, obviously, outside. What attracted you to or what led you to include her amongst certainly many, many writers?
Well, what I love most about her is that she was, she saw the importance in recording our stories. You know, she, as much as she was a writer, she was an anthropologist. She saw the value that stories have in our cultures, and she went on to go on and do research in the Caribbean and record all kinds of Caribbean stories. And I think that it's really important to acknowledge that, you know, regardless of the tensions between societies and, you know, whether or not, you know, she chose to incorporate that as a conflict or, you know, put them against one another, it's all part of our story. And I think it's really important to record things as they were. I think it's just really incredible to me that she had this wherewithal to do that in a time and place where it's hard to look at history. History is not easy to look at and spend a lot of time thinking about, but she got it, and it's really cool.
And you also, of course, you include a Oprah Winfrey. What, I mean, obviously she's somebody you can't miss, right? And is superseded any bounds, I think, most people would suggest. In fact, obviously, people were even talking about her recently running for president, which she said that she was not into, wasn't her thing. What about her? And what did you try to capture about her that we maybe not are necessarily aware of, given all the celebrity?
Yeah, I was really reluctant to put Oprah in the book. I really, you know, I thought, you know, everybody knows Oprah, so, you know, I'm not going to provide much for the story that no one's read before. And, you know, there's some names in the book that I had never heard of, and most people have never heard of. So I was wary of someone so big. But I was reading her story, and it just really struck me in the way that I felt like I was connecting to these women's stories. I was just overwhelmed with how empathy is like Oprah's secret power. It's incredible. You know, it was the thing that got her fired from one of her first jobs because she was connecting too much to people's stories and getting too emotionally involved. But to take what could have been a flaw and turn it into a $1 billion, like, organization and company and industry, it's just so amazing. You know, and despite, regardless of how big her shows got, regardless of, you know, how it's expanded into, you know, the world of Oprah, it's about the human connection to people that that separated her from the pack. And I think it's just really, really lovely. Like, it's hard to know what you're good at. You know, I wrote this book thinking a lot about myself as a young person, because it took me a really, really long time to figure out what I wanted to do. And I only started illustrating children's books less than 2 years ago. So, you know, 2 years ago, I wouldn't even know I would be here. So I was really driven to showcase a wide variety of fields of study. Whenever I had the opportunity, I would mention what school that person studied at. And it was important for me to ensure that there was a doctor, a nurse, a physician, an engineer, a mathematician, a sculptor, when I decided that I wanted to study art, as a kid, I thought that being an artist meant being a painter. And it took me so long to realize that there are so many opportunities out there for someone who does the things that I do. So it was equally as important for me to include a filmmaker, a sculptor, a painter. And in the case of Oprah, I think it's just so cool to know that her personal connection to people helped her build her career. So I thought that might be a really nice pairing with the rest of the book.
Now, you also have Katherine Johnson, who is with NASA, and obviously her figure has been made famous by the film Hidden Figures. Were you aware of her role before you sat down upon it? I mean, most people certainly were not aware of the contribution of the three women who were portrayed in the film, but Katherine Johnson in particular.
I read Margot Lee Shetterly's book half a year before the movie came out, before I knew there was a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And then everyone was talking about it. So I thought it was important to include a couple of names that, that people might want to learn a little bit more about. Again, in that same kind of conversation about what's a part of the mainstream, who's not a part of the mainstream, hers was definitely one that I thought, despite the fact that everyone knows this name now, it was really important to include a mathematician in this book, because sometimes it's easy to forget that there are roles out there for people who like math. It doesn't have to be a hugely glamorous thing. Actually, in the case of Oprah, I really love thinking about it like a secret talent, a secret weapon, honestly. In the case of Katherine Johnson, how cool that math could take her all the way, to help put a man on the moon. When she finished school, she thought that there was only the only job she could have would be a teacher, and so she started teaching in the public school system. And it wasn't until someone mentioned to her that there would be a possibility to work at the Langley Center that she moved on. It's really just amazing. It's just, sometimes it just requires one person to tell you that what you're doing is special and what you're doing is important and can change the world. So that story was great.
So talking about somebody doing something special, but maybe not even knowing, I'm thinking of Nichelle Nichols on Star Trek, and how she was persuaded to stay, because at one point she said, "Gee, this is a nothing part."
Yeah, so I love this story about Nichelle Nichols. I'm a big Star Trek fan, and I love her. But her background was in stage and theater, and she didn't. Television was this new medium for her. And obviously, I'm not an actor, but I know that actors feel a different kind of energy when they're in front of a live audience. So I can imagine, what kind of trade-off it might have been. But Star Trek had a particular place in history. I mean, it was a very diverse cast on mainstream television, and it was at the height of the civil rights movement. And people didn't love seeing this racially diverse cast on their television. So people would write in complaining about it. And the producers responded by cutting her roles and kind of relegating her to the background a little bit. And so she was getting a little bit frustrated and feeling like, I don't love television. But it was a chance encounter at an NAACP event. Who would she meet but Martin Luther King Jr., who said, "I'm a Trekkie. I love what you're doing. This is amazing. People need to see you on television." Her role was so landmark. She was one of the first African-American women on primetime television that was not playing in the role of service or a maid. Uhura, the character, was smart and brave. She was a communications officer, and she was just so cool and savvy on screen. And he told her, this is so important. People need to see this. It's powerful. Representation matters. And I love that, because it's really hard to see the value in the things that you're doing when you're struggling with them. And for someone to remind you that, that what you're doing is important, is it can be so powerful. And I mean, like, who can't listen to Martin Luther King Jr. when he comes up to you and tells you to stay in your job? But his words would ring so true, because who would grow up to become a Star Trek fan but Mae Jemison, who was the first African-American woman in space. She grew up with an image of herself in space, but didn't have the confidence that there was a place for her at NASA. She went to school, became an engineer, and entered in the Peace Corps. In the time that she was away, she saw that Sally Ride had gone to space and thought, okay, you know, things are changing at NASA, but I really don't know if there's a place for an African-American woman in the astronaut program. But it was seeing Nichelle Nichols play Lieutenant Uhura that really inspired her to finally apply to the NASA program. And she did, and she became the first African-American woman in space. And it's just like, it's so cool that just an image of yourself, or, you know, to be able to see yourself in someone else's image can make so much of a difference.
Let me ask you this finally in the minute so we have left. Well, what do you make of the portrayal of African-American, particularly African-American women and African-Americans in general? We have obviously a new film coming out based on the comic book series Black Panther that's coming out. But what do you make of the images that we're now getting as opposed to, say, in previous decades?
You know, I think a lot about this in, like, representation in movies and television and even toys. I feel like the kids from my generation, I guess I'm categorized as a millennial, I think we're all growing up and we're getting the jobs where we get to create the things that we've never seen before. So I'm really excited about where the world is. The toys are getting cooler. The movies are getting cooler. And it's because you have a generation of folks that grew up on television. I think, I try to think of the world as a more positive place. So I think I'm really excited to see where things are going. You know, I love seeing all of these comic book movies on screen, and that Black Panther is finally coming out. I think that I grew up in a very small town, but you know, television and the internet really kind of created this kind of global community. So I definitely think about the world in this more diverse way, and now that I have the opportunity to create content, I'm thinking a lot about the things that I never had. So I felt inclined to make this book kind of as a tribute to the little girls who don't know what they want to study in the world, to the quiet kids who want to make art. But I think that we're heading in a positive direction.
We've been speaking with Vashti Harrison. She is the author and illustrator of a new book, children's book, Little Leaders, Bold Women in Black History. And Vashti, we appreciate you taking the time to chat with us.
Thank you so much.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC14.org.